Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. Academic scholarships are automatically offered to eligible students upon admission, and all Luther students receive some form of financial aid. Luther.edu.
Support for WPR comes from the Dram Corporation, manufacturers of commercial tools, equipment, and systems for greenhouse and nursery professionals for over 80 years. More information is at dramm.com.
As certain as I know the sun is fire, where have you lurked that you make doubt of it? Ne'er through an arch so hurried the blown tide as the recomfited through the gates. Why hark you? The trumpets, sackbuts, psalteries, and fifes, tabors and cymbals, and the shouting Romans make the sun dance. Hark you! For Shakespeare, the sackbut, an early form of the trombone, was an instrument of fanfares larger than life and occasions of vast state importance. And the trombone, the modern trombone, is an instrument that we hear a lot at this time of year. How did the rather ungainly-looking instrument come by its distinctive slide? What has it meant to composers over the ages? And how is it used in music today? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. The questions are a good reason to listen to some good music, featuring prominently the trombone, and our guide is Mark Hetzler, professor of trombone at the UW-Madison School of Music. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Well, there is a lot of music to get through if we're going to sample broadly the sound of the trombone. But just briefly, I suppose, how did it develop, and what did the sackbut look like compared to the modern trombone?
Well, it's kind of funny because the trombone of all the instruments is the least evolved in a way, or one could look at it the opposite way. It's sort of the most evolved. It really hasn't had much in the way of change over the years. If you look at a modern trombone and if you look at a sackbut, they're actually almost identical. Maybe a little thinner metal in the sackbut, possibly a bit narrower bell on the sackbut, but it's more or less the same design that it always has been. And it's really kind of a simple design, really. If you straighten it out, it's one long tube. The reason that they bend it into two S-curves is so that you can actually hold the instrument and have it fit in an ensemble. And really, the way that you change the pitch on the trombone is you move the slide either in or out. Actually, the term sackbut comes from the old French sache-bouche, which means push-pull, essentially pushing and pulling the slide in and out.
Isn't that kind of high-tech? Is there another instrument that does that, actually has that kind of a slide?
It's really kind of rare. There are no other instruments that have a slide that changes the pitch exclusively. You will find slides on trumpets, tubas, French horns, and those slides actually move in and out to alter the pitch. But you're looking at valve usage to change the pitch on those instruments. That's why I think the trombone is, it's funny, as primitive as it is, I guess the initial design way, way back when has been the same all the way up to today.
And capable of playing notes in between notes, unlike many other instruments?
That's the beauty of the trombone. It's somewhat similar to the cello in terms of its range or tessitura, but it's also very similar to the human voice in the sense that you can maneuver between pitches either grotesquely or rather eloquently.
Relatively easy for a glissande, I suppose.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Where does the trombone first turn up in symphonic music?
Well, it's been in the orchestra for quite a long time. You can date it way back into the early Baroque. You can find it in the music of Bach, Mozart. But the first time it actually appears in a symphony, not a symphony orchestra, but the form of a symphony is, at least as far as I can tell, is in the Fifth Symphony of Beethoven. And he makes us wait until the last movement, like a lot of composers do. But boy, it's quite an entrance.
It's almost hard to sort out the trombones. There's so much going on there, but it certainly is a triumphal movement. I think that's another innovation in that symphony is his prominent use of the piccolo in that final movement.
Right, that's right, yeah. He's not the only composer to make us wait. Schumann, Brahms made us wait in a couple of symphonies, and it's funny. I mean, you sit there in the trombone section, and you literally wait until the final movement. You can't play a note, and it's kind of an icy way to, you know, start off the concert, having those around you playing and playing and playing for, you know, 20, 30, 40 minutes, and all of a sudden you pick up the trombone and off you go. But that's a great, great symphony and a really fun entrance.
At the same time, another composer who, well, a little earlier than Beethoven, but was very thoughtful about what instruments he used to what effect was Mozart.
He uses it quite extensively in his masses, his Requiem to be specific, also his Mass in C. But here we get into sort of one of the earlier usages of the trombone. It's a very vocal-like instrument. And the design of the trombone is such that you actually have four different styles or types. The most commonly played today is the tenor trombone. You also have a bass trombone, which is larger. Now, going the other direction, you have an alto trombone. And Mozart uses all three of these instruments, the alto, the tenor, and the bass trombone in his Requiem. And if you look at the score, you'll notice that the alto trombone practically mirrors the alto vocal part in the chorus. The tenor mirrors the tenors, and the bass trombone mirrors the bass parts. There's also a soprano trombone. It's typically played by trumpet players. Some trombone players can play it. It's a rather small instrument with a very small mouthpiece. But Mozart scored specifically for the alto, the tenor, and the bass. One big feature in his Requiem is in the tuba mira movement, which happens right past the Dies Irae, which actually opens with a solo trombone. Nothing else is heard in the orchestra, and it's the second trombone or the tenor that takes this part. And it's a duet that's formed between the tenor trombone and the bass vocal soloist.
Mozart did like to have instruments reflect or even represent voices in there. That's a classic example of him doubling them up. What effect is he after emotionally, do you think, with the trombones in this part of his Requiem?
Well, if you go to the previous movement, the Dies Irae, it's basically the wrath of God's judgment, the Day of Wrath. And right out of that is this fanfare. You hear the solo trombone, and the words of the bass as he comes in are, "The trumpet will send its wondrous sound throughout earth's graves and gather all before the throne." So you have this noble instrument announcing this statement from the bass player, who will then come in and sing.
I would think that a composer who would put the trombone to good use, although I can't think of an example right now, but he tended to write for such large, diverse orchestras, was Berlioz. Do we find anything in Berlioz?
Oh, yes. Yeah. A lot of marches. The Symphonie Fantastique has outrageous trombone parts.
What about Wagner?
Well, of course, Wagner uses the brass extensively. And in the trombone section, you have a lot to do. I've brought in an excerpt of the Valkyrie, the Rite of the Valkyrie specifically. And it features the brass a lot, but you really get the focus on the low brass section, the trombones and the tuba, in this excerpt.
Thank you. How many trombones does it take to pull that part off?
Well, there's usually about four in the section, or three. It depends on the orchestra that's doing it, but basically three parts. And again, you've got, well, I think in this case, it's the, written out as alto, tenor, and bass. But typically for Wagner operas, usually large bore instruments like the large tenors are used, plus a bass, a large bass on the bottom.
Well, somebody else who thought big, certainly, in terms of his orchestra and, well, the symphonies that he wrote was Mahler. Do we have prominent trombone parts in Mahler, or
are they
just part of the orchestral wash?
No, it's definitely a featured instrument, in some cases as a soloist. In the Third Symphony, there's a huge trombone solo. I've actually brought in the chorale for the second movement, and I just wanted to highlight what noble usage of the trombone can sound like. Typically, composers, if they want to tone things down or settle things down, get into a more of a reflective mode, they'll feature the trombone section in a chorale setting. And again, it goes back to this idea of the vocal nature of the instrument. In this case, you're going to hear four trombones. The Second Symphony of Mahler is scored for four trombones. And in this chorale, you're going to hear all four trombones as well as the tuba. This is in the fifth and final movement of Mahler's Second Symphony.
Well, they do hold their own there. They actually do come in quite prominently in setting the tone, a more somber tone here.
Definitely. It's a very dark, rich sound, especially when you get a harmony going and there's three or four of them playing at the same time. It's also very vocal-like.
Everybody gets time in the sun in Ravel's Bolero. So what do the trombones do that add something to distinctive, let's say, to the proceedings?
Well, I suppose it's kind of the character of the trombone. You think of it in jazz settings as having that sort of beautiful vocal quality, especially in ballads. Of course, in the bolero, it's a huge solo for trombonists. You know, every time you see it on the calendar and every trombonist who has to play it, it makes your pulse go a little bit faster. It's it's definitely a difficult solo to pull off. This particular recording that I brought in is recorded by a really good friend of mine, Doug Wright, who's the principal trombonist of the Minnesota Orchestra. And this was recorded, I think, probably about 10 years ago. A.G. Owies, the conductor. And I think Doug really pulls it off nicely in this performance. It's you can hear his rich tone and his, you know, what he's doing in between the notes to just sort of slide back and forth. It's a very beautiful rendition.
Thank you.
That is very distinctive, too. What effect do you think the trombone is here? I mean, it's not certainly not jazzy with those kind of, like, rolled notes, but what is Ravel up to? I mean, he's such a master orchestrator.
Well, it's such a sensuous piece. I mean, the unfortunate thing is, you know, some people think back to the movie 10, but, you know, it is a very sexy piece, and I think that the trombone is one of the instruments that can really pull that kind of energy out of the music.
We're going to go back in time a bit in a moment and look at composer like Leopold Mozart, who was certainly very inventive, though not usually thought of that way. And we'll come forward quite a bit, too, and look at the trombone in some other settings when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
The staff at WPR Audience Services is knowledgeable, friendly, and helpful. They often know the answer to your question right away. If they don't, they'll work hard to get the answer and get back to you. Call Audience Services, 800-747-7444.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Mark Hetzler, and we're listening to the trombone through the ages in its various contexts and moods. So far, Mark, we've looked at the trombone in a symphonic context, but at what point does it actually become, you know, the star?
Well, I think you have to go back to the classical era. The solo trombone repertoire that we have today is certainly growing, but it's really probably the last 30 years that has made our solo repertoire worth comparing to other instruments. Before that, we really basically had barely anything at all. I mean, if you look at solo violin repertoire, solo piano repertoire, they've got huge amounts of music to draw on. We had a couple of near misses with greatness. Michael Haydn, Papa Haydn's brother, wrote us a concerto. A man named Ferdinand David, who was the concertmaster of Mendelssohn and Mendelssohn's orchestra, wrote us a concerto when Mendelssohn couldn't really have the time to get around to writing it. And, of course, we're going to listen to right now by a piece by Mozart, a solo piece written in a concerto setting. But it's not by Wolfgang. It's by his father, Leopold Mozart. This is recorded by an outstanding soloist, one of my favorite all time, Alain Trudel. He's a Canadian solo trombonist, plays jazz, classical, and in this setting, you're going to hear him playing the alto trombone, the smaller instrument, as a soloist with an orchestra of strings.
And then what's the actual piece? Is it a concerto?
It's an interesting work. It's a 9-movement serenade, and from this 9-movement serenade, it's often these 3 movements that feature the solo trombone are extracted and performed as a concerto.
So in this serenade, 9-movement serenade, Leopold Mozart is bringing out really kind of a soulful quality in the trombone, at least in this movement.
Oh, definitely. And when you hear the trombone played like this, I think it really sort of shows off what you can do with the instrument. It's a very lyrical instrument.
So, I mean, a few trombone concertos along the way. Rimsky-Korsakov wrote a kind of a shortish one in the late 19th century. But somewhere along the line, the trombone really starts to sing out in pieces that are not strictly classical.
Definitely. The next excerpt is going to be featuring Arthur Pryor, who is probably the forefather of sort of the solo trombone, at least in America. He was, of course, the solo trombonist with the John Philip Sousa Band for many years, and then he went on to start his own band. He traveled all over the world. And to this day, even still, when you hear him play, it's truly phenomenal technique. This actually is a recording from 1901. You're going to hear a lot of scratches and It will sound like it's an old recording. And, of course, all these takes were live. You'll hear an announcer before he plays announcing that this is Arthur Pryor, and he'll be playing Bluebells of Scotland, a theme in variations based on a Scottish folk song.
Trombone solo, the Bluebells of Scotland, played by Mr. Arthur Pryor with Schuster's band.
No editing. That was done in one take, obviously. And he was very famous for what he could do. He sort of took an awkward instrument and made people realize, oh, wow, you can get around on this instrument just like any other instrument, you know, like an instrument with keys or valves.
Is it a unique skill to hit just the right place on the slide to get the right note?
A lot of people ask that. How do you know where to stop the slide? And it really is like any other instrument. If you look at a violin or a guitar or anything that involves a distance, even a piano to a certain degree, because, you know, when you watch a fine pianist play, they're not watching the keyboard. But it really comes down to the ear, hearing it. If you can hear it, then you can play it. And the placement of the slide has more to do with the sound rather than the feel. So that's an important thing to remember when you're teaching young people.
Well, the Arthur Pryor recording, even if it is 1901, isn't too far removed from, it seems to me, some of the effects you'd get in jazz trombone playing.
Yeah, well, the next example I brought is a few years later. Actually, the tune was written in 1931. It's Duke Ellington's It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing. There are many trombonists throughout the ages in the classical solo realm as well as the jazz. If you go into the early jazz, you have people like Kid Ory, Dickie Wells, J.C. Higginbotham. The Ellington Orchestra was just an amazing place four trombonists that came out, people like Lawrence Brown and this next person who we're going to feature, a guy named Joe Nanton, or as he goes by the name of Tricky Sam. Tricky Sam and the trumpeter, Bubba Miley, both members of the Duke Ellington Orchestra, revolutionized the way that you could use a plunger and vocalize through their instruments. And they're actually the two people that are probably most regarded as the two main ingredients of Ellington's earthy jungle sound. Tricky Sam had this amazing ability to play with a plunger, and by plunger, I literally mean a plunger mute, a literal plunger that you would use to unclog a sink or a toilet. And if you take the wooden piece off and you have just the rubber plunger itself, you can hold it in your left hand and use it to either cover or uncover the bell of the trombone. Now, if you growl or vowel, use different vowels with your embouchure, you can really get these beautiful vocal effects, as you're about to hear. This is from 1943. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
It don't mean a thing if you ain't got that swing.
It is hard to believe at times that that is a trombone and not either a human voice or something else defying description.
Well, they called him Tricky Sam for a reason.
You mentioned Jack Teagarden. What was his claim to fame when it came to virtuoso trombone playing?
Well, he goes by the name Big T, and the thing about Big T that's important is that he sort of transcended the instrument. We were talking about the slide and how it kind of gets in the way or how it can limit. And you hear a lot of trombone players, especially in the earlier styles, play what's called a tailgate, meaning they have a lot of glissandos and rips. Big T played it in a very ultra clean and smooth sort of way. It was a lot more about nuance. It was a lot more about like vocal inflection. And you're going to hear probably his trademark tune, St. James Infirmary. This was recorded live in 1947 at Town Hall. It's actually the Louis Armstrong Orchestra, although you won't hear Louis play a single note. And you'll hear Jack introduce the piece by saying, "It's one of the oldest blues I know." An important thing to note when you're listening, as you heard in the Tricky Sam excerpt, it barely sounds like a trombone at times because of the effect with the plunger. Well, what Teagarden does in this, which is really cool, is he'll do a solo in the beginning, and then he sings for a while, and then he comes back in with a trombone. But what he does is when he comes back in, he takes the bell off of the trombone, he takes a glass, like a drinking glass that's empty, and he places it over the end of the trombone where the bell would go, and then he plays into it. And you're going to hear this very eerie, like, I can't even describe it, but you'll definitely hear an interesting sound on the last part of the tune. Jack Teagarden, St. James Infirmary, 1947.
St. James Infirmary, the oldest blues I ever heard. Wherever she may be,
He can look his old wide world all over. She'll never find another man like me. Now when I die, I want you to dress me in straight last shoes. A box back coat and a Stetson hat. Put a $20 gold piece on my watch chain. So the boys will know I die standing pat.
Sound of the trombonist Jack Teagarden playing into a trombone using a drinking glass as a mute in a famous recording of St. James Infirmary. Was he sort of the apex of jazz trombonist, Jack Teagarden?
Well, it's hard to say apex. I mean, there are so many outstanding artists. He was certainly one of the biggest and is certainly a legend to this day. We're going to move now to a guy named J.J. Johnson, who some people would say is the apex. There are certainly some maybe more adept technicians that have come along since, but J.J. sort of took the trombone in the bebop era and did with it what people were doing on the saxophone and the trumpet. You know, you think about what Charlie Parker and Dizzy did, and then they brought it over through Miles, and J.J. was the trombonist to sort of go along with all of this in that era and do all the technical things that these artists did on the valved and key instruments. I've got a recording from 1958 where he's the leader in the group, and this is Thelonious Monk's Mysterioso. I kind of cut it down, so all you're going to hear is four choruses of his solo.
Thank you.
J.J. Johnson, according to some accounts, the top of jazz trombonists with Mysterioso by Thelonious Monk. Well, you'd think that by now you'd have heard everything a trombone can do, but not so. We're going to follow it even into contemporary times when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Did you know that many WPR programs are archived so you can listen later at WPR.org? When you'd like to listen to a program again, or you want to tune in when it's convenient for you, visit WPR.org and click on Audio Archives.
We know there are many organizations deserving of your financial support this time of year, and we're grateful you consider giving to Wisconsin Public Radio. Listener support is vital, and it's tax-deductible. I'm Joy Cardine. Give online at WPR.org or call us at 888-202-2889.
Welcome back to University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland. With me is Mark Hetzler, who is giving us insights into that ancient and very modern instrument, the trombone. We've been hearing some examples of jazz of late. Are there techniques yet to be discovered and embraced that we haven't picked up on so far?
Definitely. The trombone is the instrument, I think, most often that is sort of called on to extend itself, no pun intended. There are a lot of different techniques you can use to alter the sound of the trombone. This next artist is a guy named Albert Mangelsdorf, a contemporary of J.J. Johnson's, an outstanding bebopper in his own right. Actually, I think in many ways just as good as J.J. But early in his career, he started into this technique known as multiphonics, where you actually sing and play the trombone at the same time, simultaneously. And once he got into this style, he sort of got off the highway of bebop, took some back roads, and then never looked back. And his entire career after that was just this extension of what the instrument could do in modern settings. This is a recording taken from 1976. He's playing with a bass player, Jaco Pastorius, and a drummer, Alphonse Mouzon. This is a tune titled Trilogue.
So that would be not for dancing, obviously, not for singing along, except for the trombonist himself. What would you call that genre? Is that still jazz?
Yeah, I guess it's like modern jazz, maybe a little avant-garde thrown in there. You know, when you get into later periods, especially in the late 60s, early 70s, like most music, forms start to expand and people start to stretch. And it's an idea of, you know, trying to get to that place artistically, and you end up, I think, as a result, extending yourself. He was a phenomenal artist and was playing right up until his death. And his multiphonic techniques, I know it may sound a little funny at first, but your ears start to get used to it, and it's a tremendously virtuosic way of playing the trombone. This next artist is a guy named Robin Eubanks. His brother is Kevin Eubanks, a guitar player
for
who leads
Tonight Show.
The Tonight Show band. Robin is just as great a musician. He's played a lot with the Dave Holland Quintet, and he's done a lot of solo projects. And one of the things that Robin does, in addition to playing the trombone beyond your wildest dreams, I mean, he's a phenomenal trombonist. He'll hook it up to guitar pedals and then alter the sound of his instrument electronically. What you're going to hear here is a tune he titled REM State, and he's playing through guitar pedals. I would assume some kind of wah, maybe a little flange. Most people might hear this and think it's a guitar, but no, this is a guy playing the trombone.
Well, I wouldn't be able to identify the instrument. I would guess, however, that there was a computer involved rather than just a trombonist and a guitar pedal set.
Yeah, well, it's actually really simple. You just play into a mic. The mic sends a signal into a guitar pedal, and then the guitar pedal affects it or processes the sound, and then out it comes on the other side. But you can actually play with a computer. The next excerpt is an example of that. This is written by a friend of mine, a guy named Robert Rowe, who's based in New York. He teaches at NYU, and he runs their electronic music studio. And he actually writes interactive software where the music or where the computer listens and responds to the live player. So it's literally like playing a duet with artificial intelligence. Robert's actually from Wisconsin, and he titled this piece Arcturus. Arcturus is the star in the sky that one would look to when determining when it's time to plant or put seeds in the ground. And he was inspired. He was reading this old poem by Virgil titled Georgics. Robert's a very intellectual guy. And this poem inspired him to sort of create this piece about this star. I think it's a very galactic kind of piece. This is me playing it. This is on a recording that I'm about to release that features the trombone in settings with electronics, either computers or other types of electronics.
Arcturus. Well, I would certainly think that that piece, Arcturus, had computer involvement, but I gather now there's also a way to make things sound as if they have computers involved but don't.
Well, you had mentioned the ingenuity of Jack Teagarden using the glass to cover his slide, the plunger for Tricky Sam. A couple of composers out there have done a lot of interesting things to alter the trombone sound, but acoustically without electronics. And this next example is going to showcase that. If you take a tenor saxophone mouthpiece and you stick it into the mouthpiece of a trombone and then blow into it, you get quite a sound. You can also take a bassoon reed and place it into the mouthpiece of a trombone and blow into that, and you're going to get an interesting sound. This is a piece that a composer named James Fulkerson composed. It's got a long title. It's titled, To Work and Rework, To Come Close to Intentions is Not Experimental. Kind of a long title, I know, but it's essentially a long sort of textural improvisation. And what I've done to create this is I've recorded a lot of tracks, and then I've sort of stacked them or placed them over each other to form almost like a sonic collage. And what you hear, even though some of it may be altered with a little bit of reverb or a little bit of delay, other than that, none of this is altered electronically. It is all acoustic, just as you hear it.
No computers. Wow. That's certainly a convincing sound for having some. I can't imagine the trombone going much farther away from its original sound, its singing sound, if you will, than that. You have something to bring us back into the fold?
Yeah. Well, it will go further, and I'm constantly pushing to see how far I can go. But at the same time, I like to play a lot of traditional music, and I have a fun place in my heart for American music. I always tend to go back to that, so we might as well go back to a piece by Aaron Copland. One of my most favorite pieces by him has always been Appalachian Spring. And other than a small trombone part, which has a really nice solo, there's not a whole lot for the trombone to do in this piece. So what I actually did was I took the very end, which is sort of a chorale. He titled it Like a Prayer. And I arranged it in a setting for solo piano and solo trombone, and hopefully it'll bring across the singing style of the trombone in ways that most people don't expect.
Thank you.
Mark Hetzler's arrangement of the finale of Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring called Like a Prayer. That's you as the trombonist there?
That's right. That's me and a friend of mine, Lisa Leonard, on piano.
Very soulful and a wonderful conclusion to this hour of discussion about the trombone. I know that I, for one, will be listening more carefully to those brass instruments at this time of year, in fact, throughout the year, to say, oh, that's a trombone. Thanks for being with me for this hour.
Thanks for having me here. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you'll join Emily Auerbach and me for the next hour of University of the Air.